Good morning. It's that time of the semester, isn't it? That was a weary good morning. How many more weeks do you have? Two, three? 2 weeks. How many hours? Yeah. Seniors especially. Except, where are you going? Come on down. We need the tax money. Well, I'm delighted to be here with you. We are neighbors to you in Orlando. You may not know this. Both the seminary across the street and you have a presence next to one of our seven campuses, our East Campus. And we're here in part to strengthen that relationship and find ways for students who live in Orlando, would like the experience you've enjoyed, but can't quite stretch their finances to get there, to be able to spend a couple of years with us at low cost and then be able to afford their last 2 years in your community of learning and faith. So we're glad to be here. And I want to talk to you very briefly about work, because some of you are just about to be banished from this oasis into the wilderness of work. And some of you know what wilderness specifically you're going into, and some of you don't. How many of you have no real clue where you'll be 5 years from now? Me too. My arms raised. Some of you are freshmen and saying, I plan to be here 5 years from now. I understand. I want you to turn to Psalm 83 if you have your scriptures with you. We're going to just get your finger in there. We're going to read a bit of this in a minute, but I want to start with a poem of my own. We're going to read two poems at the beginning. This poem is called Brickwork. My father-in-law, Bob, died about 10 years ago. He was a good friend, and he and I couldn't have been more different. I've moved almost every year of my life growing up, lived all over the world, had one of those ADD lives until I grew up. Bob had lived in the house he built 100 yards from the house he was born in, built it before he got married because he thought it was irresponsible to get married without having already built a house. And he lived his entire life in that house. And aside from a year and a half in the military during the end of World War II, he only ever really had one job, working for a brick company. And he did everything you can do in brick. He laid brick, he hauled brick, he made brick, he tested brick, he did quality control on brick. He finished his life selling brick. He was a brick man. When we would travel together to the beach and we'd stop at some restaurant and go inside, Bob would lag behind. And I'd say, where's Bob? And Betsy, his wife, would say, he's looking at the brick. He was a brick man. And I began to think, what's it like to do something like that all your life? And this little poem popped out. Listen carefully. Brickwork. It wasn't a work I had chosen, but I was young, and the job came to hand like each new rasp-edged brick. And I was taken with the challenge of the craft, head down to lay to a line straight and square, feeling the grain of baked earth and handling the sanded mud with quick, smart flicks and jabs, a precision boxer working a square ring, mastering tools and letting them master me, hammer, level, and trowel. Focusing until every cell is in the rhythm, speed, economy of motion, each brick leading to the next, no hesitation, no space between the notes, and all notes the same, year stacked on year, until brick to brick, course on course, until I take on the very texture of brick, the grit of mortar, flat face, and rigid joints. No view but the brick. No plan but the brick. No dream but the brick. And then the walls at last connect. And there's nothing to do but to set the iron bars in the tiny high window and wait for the end. For some people, work's a prison. They made it themselves. They're lost in it, and they can't get out. Work can be many, many things. For some people, work is creativity, co-creation. For some, it's a curse, a prison. For some, work is domination. subjugation of others. For some, it's competition, winning, losing. What's work meant to be? You will spend most of the rest of your life working. What's it going to be? What's it going to mean? What did God intend it to mean? I'm not talking so much about your particular callings. You'll have many probably through your life. But the whole experience of work, where did it come from? I want to share just a little bit with you a biblical view of work. And I want to answer a question for you. If you want to know what's my calling, I can answer that question for you today. At least in part. Because it's in Psalm 83. But it's the part of the psalm we hardly ever read. You know Psalm 83. How lovely is your dwelling place? How many times have you sung this song? Turn to it now if you've got it. Let's read just a little bit of Psalm 83. Oops. Sorry, Psalm 84. It's late. Psalm 84. How lovely is your dwelling place, O Lord Almighty. My soul yearns, even faints, for the courts of the Lord. My heart and my flesh cry out for the living God. Even the sparrow has found a home, and the swallow a nest for herself, where she may have her young, a place near your altar, O Lord Almighty, my King and my God. Blessed are those who dwell in your house. They are ever praising you. Do you have the image? This is a psalm spoken by a pilgrim. It's a poem written for a pilgrimage when maybe just an ordinary guy or woman makes their one pilgrimage to Jerusalem of the year. They leave their mud hut and their grueling work, and they climb the long road to Jerusalem to worship in the temple. And they think about it all year. It's the festival of the year. It's the party. And when he gets there, this is the image he has. How good it is to be here. I don't ever want to be anywhere else. He envies the birds. Remember, the temple in Jerusalem's kind of open air. And he envies the birds that have nested in the mud and stone walls in the interior courtyard of the temple. If I could just be like one of them, always to live near your dwelling, in your house. Good place to be, isn't it? And then comes the part of the psalm we never read, because we usually skip from there to the end and say, better is one day in your courts and so forth. But the middle of the psalm is hugely important. It says, blessed are those who dwell in your house, they're ever praising you. Blessed are those whose strength is in you, who have set their hearts on pilgrimage. As they pass through the valley of Baca, they make it a place of springs. The autumn rains also cover it with pools. They go from strength to strength till each appears before God in Zion. What's the valley of Baca? The word means desolation. The valley of Baca, the place of complete and utter loss, when your child has died, when your husband has left you, with the deepest disappointments of your life. That's what Baca means. Blessed are those whose strength is in you. Blessed are those whose strength is in you, who have set their hearts on pilgrimage as they pass through the valley of Baca, the place of desolation. They make it a place of springs. The autumn rains also cover it with pools. There are many valleys of Baca. I want to speak to the valleys of Baca you will encounter at work. This might surprise you. My organization employs a couple thousand people. A lot of them are miserable, unhappy, lives ruined, mixed up, angry. There are a lot of valleys out there. Here's the calling to the pilgrims of God. Make it a place of springs. Go into the desert, and as you pass through, you make it a place of springs. Your calling in the world is to bring blessing where it's needed. You want to know what your calling at work is? Don't care what your job is. It's to be a blessing. To be blessed. To make the desert a place of springs. How do you do that? Well, it's tricky. It's very tricky because the valley is working on you as much as you're working on it. Most people are confused about work. Many Christians believe work is a curse, that it's a result of the fall. But if you'll read Genesis 1 through 3 carefully, and I encourage you to do this, you'll discover a couple things. You'll discover first, God works. He's a working God. And what he proclaimed over his work is, it's good. Work is a good thing. This is before the fall. And then when he made humanity, he gave them a charge to work with him. Gave them, remember, to rule over all creation. And there's a scene where Adam names the animals. And then a chapter or so later, again, he puts them in the garden and tells them to till it and care for it. The words of rule over, till, and so on are words of stewardship. We were given responsibility for caring for creation. Some of you know that phrase, creation care, as a sort of Christian view of environmental responsibility. And that's good. This extends beyond that. All the universe we share in, we have some responsibility for. God made it that way. And we were to work at that. Care of culture, care of civilization, care of one another, care of community, care of our politics, care. We're supposed to care for. That's our work. And then in the fall, something very strange happened. You understand the fall. It's like all of creation was this beautiful mirror reflecting God, and somebody out of selfishness took the brick of ego and threw it through the mirror and shattered the image. And when you look at the pieces of the mirror, you still see little bits, fragments of a reflection of God's glory in it. Don't you? You can still see goodness in other people. You can still see blessing in the earth, except everything's broken and fragmented and chaotic. That's what sin did. That's the world we live in. And that's the world God's doing this amazing extreme makeover on. The costliest rehab project in the universe to put the image back together. And he's invited us into it. And the curse, remember when he cursed Adam, he said, cursed is the ground because of you. He didn't say you're cursed. Cursed is the ground because of you. Read it carefully. Here's what it means. The curse placed on us is not work, it's toil. That is fruitless work. Fruitlessness in our work is a curse. And you'll experience that in your life. And that's what God's healing. He's redeeming our work, just like he's redeeming all the rest of the universe that's broken. And he wants you to partner with him in making the redemption of work happen. You have a calling to every organization you might work with, a redemptive calling to help heal work, to make it fruitful again. That's what healing it means. To heal the curse of fruitlessness by making it fruitful. And you know how to make it fruitful, don't you? There are four kinds of fruit God calls us to. There's the fruit of just doing good work. The work is good. Good craft. Good craftsmanship. Every time you as a disciple sit down to do a task, God wants you to do it the best you know how. It may seem like a meaningless task. It has meaning because you care. And because he cares, to do good work. Every paper you write, every study session, and now in the future, everything else you do. Good work. God wants to see that fruit. Good works, a second kind of fruit God expects. Remember Colossians, I think it says that we were made for good works that were prepared for us to do beforehand. That's our calling, to do good acts of charity and mercy and grace while you're at work. I'm president of a big college. I cannot tell you whether God cares that our strategic plan gets fulfilled. But I'm certain he cares what I say to the stranger on the street and how I treat the person in the elevator whose name I don't quite remember. That's good works. He wants fruit in good works to be conscious. We're not practicing random acts of kindness, but highly intentional acts of kindness everywhere we can. That's good works. The third fruit is fruit for the kingdom, to call others by the witness you are, not just the witness you say. It says to be a witness, not to speak a witness. The witness you are every day brings fruit to the kingdom. That is, grows the kingdom, re-knits people back to a relationship with God. That's the third kind of fruit expected of all of us. And the fourth fruit is fruit in you, in your character. Good work, godly work, redeemed work changes you, remakes your own character, who you are every day. Now, this is a hard lesson, and it's usually learned in reverse. I learned it myself early in my career when I was thrust into work way over my head, put in a place of leadership at age 25 that I'd never imagined. A big bureaucratic organization, plenty of palace politics, lots of power, winners and losers. And I really hadn't planned to have a job when I was in a seat like yours right now. I thought, I'll write poems and make music and someone will take care of me. And I took this job as a temporary thing, and just one thing led to another. And I was vice president of a 800,000 student system of colleges at age 25. And everybody laughed and said, he won't make it 6 months. And I thought, I won't make it 3 months. But I kept my mouth shut and I listened and I learned the craft of palace politics, of bureaucratic hierarchical organizations and all that stuff. Learned how to do it. Got good, pretty good at it, really. Within a year or two, I was the golden boy. He's the up-and-comer. Look at him. As young as he is, he's going to be something. And I think I must have heard them and listened to them. Then one day, something very important happened for me. I went to a staff meeting. I go to a lot of meetings. That's one of the curses of fruitlessness in work. I went to a staff meeting, and while I was there, I hurt somebody. I hurt somebody, another member of the staff, somebody I cared about. I'm not sure exactly what I said. Maybe I withheld some information I could have given her before the meeting that would have helped her. Maybe I proved I was smarter than her by dissembling her logic in front of everybody else. Likely, I just went for a laugh, made a crack, because I have that kind of a personality. And I touched her in some place that was infinitely more sensitive than I could have imagined. And she was hurt. Now, this happens every day in almost every staff meeting. And instead of swallowing it and going home and kicking the dog, she followed me back to my office. And she gave me this great gift. She closed the door and let me have it. And she said, let me hold up a mirror for you. You're not who you think you are. You're not who you say you are. This is who you really look like. And I looked in the mirror and I said, oh, wow, you're right. I'm sorry. Went home thinking, what does this all mean? Over the course of the weekend, what I discerned wasn't just that I wasn't who I thought I was, but that I was becoming someone I didn't want to be. And it was happening to me at work. The more success I had, the uglier my character became. And I awakened to the fact that those jerks, the old burned out husks of human beings, the dead bureaucrats who are still hanging around, that us young guys all made fun of, started out just like me. My character was being deformed by what I did every day. remember this. Your work forms you more powerfully than you form it. That's why there's so many deformed people. So I went looking for another way to get along in the world, some way of being responsible and doing leadership roles without creating harm. It's not easy to do. And I discovered three things that were hugely important. The first was I was thrown back at the feet of Jesus to rethink John 15. You know John 15, the first 10, 15 verses or so. It's at the Last Supper. He's talking with his disciples, and he says, I am the vine, you are the branches. My Father is the vine dresser. You can only bear fruit in me. If you abide in me and I abide in you, you'll bear fruit. If you don't, you'll get pruned. What I experienced was a gracious pruning. So the first thing I had to learn again was, how do I abide in Christ in every moment of every working day? In a secular organization that's power-laden and full of craziness, where there's a lot of money and people and reputation and power on the line, how do I abide in Christ in every transaction? The second thing I learned was that it's way more important to do my interior work than my exterior work. The most important work God's given you to do is in here. And you do your interior work every day. And then you do your exterior work. And you try to make this connection between your interior work and your exterior work, so that what you do in the world is an expression of who you really are and who you really are trying to become. That connection is what we call integrity. Between interior work and exterior work. And then if you work at it hard, you'll get good at it, better at it. And there's a chance you can connect your interior work and your exterior work to the work, to God's great work. You can actually be a help instead of a hindrance. But only if that integrity is already there. God called me and calls you to your interior work, fully in the Asbury tradition of holiness and piety and inner awareness. Lastly, I learned that what's needed most at work, the first expression of God's fruit in work, is forgiveness, is grace. All these broken people rubbing up against each other with conflicting purposes and fears and needs and worries, bound to hurt each other, bound to dent each other's fenders. And there's so little forgiveness. Later in my careers, I've assumed roles of even greater responsibility. I've learned how important forgiveness is in the organization. There's the kind of forgiveness I needed when I hurt my friend, the ordinary, courteous forgiveness. Let's deal with it now. Keep our lists short. When it's done with, it's done. Forgive and forget, not forgive and remember. But there's another kind of forgiveness that's needed. You see, I've learned in my work that all of the win-win decisions when things go wrong, the problem-solving decisions that are win-win, don't come to me. They're handled deep in the organization. First-line supervisors can figure out, this is a win-win, I'm going to do it. And the win-lose decisions don't come to me. They come on up the line a little above middle management. Sometimes senior managers are dealing with win-lose decisions. I'm going to make a decision here. Somebody's going to get hurt, but somebody's going to get blessed. You know, sometimes that has to be done. The only kind of decisions that come to me anymore are lose-lose. And that's the way it's supposed to be. And every day I face some kind of choice where I know no matter what I do, Somebody gets hurt. Somebody pays a price. Somebody's disappointed. Have to make those decisions every day. And by the way, not making a decision has consequences too. And if I couldn't find a way to be forgiven for that by God, by myself, and ultimately, I hope, by the people who are harmed, I couldn't make a decision. I'd be paralyzed. Forgiveness is essential. It's the first fruit of the gospel at work. And you should be an engine of forgiveness and healing, no matter where you work. Most people are account keepers. Most people have a ready list of every way in which they've been slighted. God calls us to a different kind of life and work. You want to know if your work is a blessing in the Valley of Baca? The beginning of those springs are springs of forgiveness. Remember Jesus' use of that image with the woman at the well. New life comes through forgiveness. Be an engine of forgiveness. I was asked to make a little music. I'll only inflict one song on you to close.
Found a river to an ocean. Concrete sky and a stone cold sea came to where the emptiness cracked open. Into the fire of my sorrow, but I found my strength in forgiving you. I never even dreamed how far my heart could go. To give this life beyond each death, from this deeper well of trust, to know that when there's nothing left, you will always have what you give. You give to love. In this life, the love you give will be the only lasting treasure. And what you give will be what you gain, a well that echoes down too deep to measure. A silver coin rings down that well, and you can never spend too much. A diamond echoes deeper still. You will always have what you give to love. You will always have what you give. You give to love. Peace.